Welcome to Net Zero Investor with Mona, where we discuss how investors tackle climate change, the biggest issue of the 21st century. Today, we want to take a closer look at defined contribution funds and their approach to climate change. That's really timely, not only because the UK government is proposing some major changes to the DC sector, which could see a significant consolidation of master trusts, but also because we got our annual defined contribution forum coming up on the 30th of January. So make sure you register for that. So I'm really pleased today that we've got Nico Aspinall with us. Nico is head of sustainable product advocacy at Newton Investment Management. And of course, he will chair our DC forum again in January. Nico is also co-host of the popular Value for Money podcast and has some history on DC investing. When we first met, you were CIO at BNCE, which is more commonly known as the People's Pension. And Nico has been DC investor since 2007. We've also got Jo Sharples with us. Jo's been with Aon for nearly 24 years, and she's currently CIO for Aon's DC solutions, which covers nearly $8 billion across contract-based schemes and includes also the Master Trust. Like most DC providers, Aon's growth offering is predominantly invested in equities. So Jo should be the ideal candidate to answer some of our questions. Thanks for joining us today, Jo and Nico.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Thank you. Yeah, pleasure to be here.
Okay, thanks for coming. And of course, equities are still the main component for most DC investors, and especially the master trusts in their growth stage. They're mainly invested in equities. The largest master trusts all have net zero targets in place, Aon included. So how can DC investors put equities to work to best support a transition and deliver returns? What do you think, Jo?
Yeah, so for members, they need us to be able to deliver those equity returns to provide that growth to support those outcomes. But we also need, when we're kind of investing in that equity, to recognise that some of the companies will be better placed than others to navigate what lies ahead. So, for example, that energy, that all-important transition. And I think for us, that is really important when we then think about the strategy, we think about what risks our members are going to be facing, but also what are the opportunities and actually how do we capture those? And that impacts how we then think about equity investment, how we build our strategies. So to give you a couple of examples, strategies like sort of active impact equities can play a really important role in that, allowing members to access some of those opportunities. Equally, we've got a really large book of passive equities. And so it's actually thinking about how do we get the most value out of those and how do we invest those to benefit from the transition?
Nico, what are Newton's thoughts on that?
Yeah, so we're an active manager. So we have the sort of luxury of selecting assets. And I think the theme of climate action, we kind of broadly think about as sort of three buckets. So thinking about the transition of the emissions of the developed world today. So finding companies in the sectors with the most to do, the companies that are doing the most in those sectors. So then climate solutions. So you can see that as opportunities for businesses to address the emissions of others. So finding companies with products that reduce those emissions. And we might come on to a scope three conversation. That's the excitement of my life at the moment. And then the third bucket is emerging markets. It's sort of both of the above, but it's a critical understanding that we need to have that the future remaining global carbon budget is very dedicated to emerging markets. And you can't have a sort of straight line. We expect emissions to reduce from a baseline of 2019 in the emerging markets in the same way. And things like SBTI, science-based targets, don't apply in the same way. So it's a sort of special call out for that kind of transition finance and solution companies.
That's an interesting point. How much of it is data issues? Is data improving on these companies?
Yeah, I mean, data's getting better all the time. I think it is this sort of virtuous circle between again, speaking as an active manager, you know, we have sector analysts who are doing the work, looking at the individual sectors, understanding what the hallmarks of a credible transition plan look like. And then we're trying to understand if that data exists already and if we can use it in our more quant-driven processes. And if it doesn't, we're members of CDP, you know, we have good interactions with a lot of the data providers. So can we go and influence those collection steps to pick up those data points around the hallmarks? And once it's in the data set, it remains. So we're getting kind of 3, 4, 5 year track records on a number of the different data points and then increasing granularity on the sort of data sets overall. So data is definitely improving.
I mean, I'd echo that in terms of we're seeing improvements in data come through. And I mean, Nico, you speak from a sort of active management perspective, recognizing we've got lots in listed equities and passively managed. Actually, I think the data availability has a really big sort of knock-on implication in terms of how you can construct those, because there's no point saying, actually, I'm going to take account of this factor when actually the data is really, really poor, because then I think you end up making not very good decisions for your members, and that can have an impact on performance. So we have seen improving data quality, and I think that's really helpful, but there's probably a little bit more to go to get to where we might like to be, particularly for some of those passive strategies.
You've touched on a really important point here, Joe, because obviously that's the starting point for a lot of DC investors. They start off by maybe shifting their index to a climate-aware strategy, as, for example, Nest has done and the People's Partnership have done. How important is it to select the right index?
Oh, that's such a big question. So I think, as you say, you do need a starting point, and you obviously need a benchmark to measure performance. I think that the big question is actually, does it have to be a climate-tilted index or not? And certainly over recent years, we've seen a huge proliferation of climate-tilted index indices. Each of them is ever so slightly different. So this is amazing business for index providers, but it does mean there is so much choice and potentially sort of additional cost that investors will incur. So I think there's probably a little bit of a word of caution amongst all that. I think one of the challenges as an investor is, because there are so many variants and a lot of them have been created for client-specific needs, is then actually, how do you know which one is best and which one's going to work best for our funds, for example? And the other aspect is, I think a lot of these climate-tilted indices naturally rely on that index provider's data. And so you're kind of making an implicit assumption that actually that is the right way to go. And actually, from our conversations with asset managers, and I have quite a few conversations with asset managers, actually a lot of them are able to bring insights that you perhaps don't get through a climate-tilted index to the portfolio. So I think that's a really interesting and probably evolving area. So I suspect in future, and actually it's something we've seen with our own, is perhaps some of the climate-tilted indices may be a little bit less relevant when you're constructing a portfolio. They're probably still a good benchmark, but I would say actually you can take a slightly broader view and you don't necessarily have to go down that route.
There's of course also a risk that if you simply invest in a developed market index, which is underweight fossil fuel companies, you just end up with a massive exposure to tech stocks, which DC funds probably tend to have anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and that's been, you know, a fantastic play, but probably pretty accidental. And if you think about the concentration of the global index in the US, the concentration of the US index in seven names, is that a climate change story or is that a bubble which DC investors are exposed to because they've sort of got this accidental approach? Now, I'll just take a step back a little bit and just ask whether a climate-tilted index, particularly if it's just tilted on emissions or tilted on emissions intensity, is really actually doing anything appropriate in the realm of climate action. I can see that there's some sort of marginal transition risk benefit, but if you take that too far, I think that sector biases that we just talked to is a really, really big risk, actually. And it's going to be an increasing one if your sort of tilting program sort of is set in stone and you're not kind of reacting to where the world has got to in terms of emissions. But really, ultimately, you're sort of defunding the sectors that have the most work to do. Consumers are still using their products. People are still being transported around with fossil fuels. They've still got electricity coming from fossil fuels. So what are you doing if you're defunding those companies? It is, I think, selection within those sectors that is the critical step. The lowest carbon steel, the lowest carbon cement, those are the building products of the future. It's not by avoiding steel and cement. We're not going to stop building as society. And then I guess from the data question, how do you actually go and find those companies, those products and services? I mentioned scope 3. You know, we should want scope 3 emissions of these best companies to go up, because that suggests they're displacing inefficient products of scope 3 of others. But if you have a measure which says all of your emissions, scope 1 and 2 and 3 should go down, then actually you're going to be penalizing the solutions companies. So you can get yourself into some real kind of tangles if you just tilt based on sort of single metrics.
Especially just focusing on reducing emissions and really simplistic. And I guess the bigger issue as well is that the growing energy intensity of those tech companies, which is probably not quite factored into low carbon indices as well, that they're going to be increasingly hungry for resources.
I mean, it's a really, really fascinating question. I mean, we were talking about it the other day internally. And if you look at someone like Google, you know, can we find data which demonstrates their emissions have gone up, right? So their energy demands for their AI training runs are now so big that they're having to draw in fossil fuels from the grid. But as a response, because they've got carbon commitments, they've got SBTI commitments, they are investing in renewables. So is there a way that we can bring from maybe OPEX or access to purchasing power agreement, those sorts of things into our data analysis? And then you can say, well, actually, we see that their emissions gone up, which in our scoring would be a bad thing. But we can also see that they're spending the money. You know, the Mag 7, particularly the US-based ones, are spending the most on renewables because they have renewable commitments. Finding the way to balance those, again, I think it's got to be active informed. It's got to be kind of understanding what the data actually gives you insight to, as opposed to just kind of using a single metric.
We've gone slightly off a tangent here, but I feel like a slightly provocative point, but in a way, just shifting equities into a low carbon index is a bit like the low hanging fruit of decarbonisation, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it can be, and I suspect that's what a lot of schemes have done, because that's kind of been the easy route to do. I do think you need to be really careful that you're not just moving the deck chairs around, because you can kind of disinvest from one company, actually someone else, you know, you reduce your carbon emissions, but the carbon emissions are still there. And so it's actually thinking about that real world impact. And are you making a genuine difference through the decisions that you're making? Nico, you've sort of talked about it already, but it's one of the big questions that I've kind of got at the moment, is actually how do you get some of the laggards and the ones that are perhaps a little bit behind the curve to move? Because I think those are the ones that make the real difference. And that's where your kind of questions about exclusion or not really come into play, because that's the danger that your laggards get excluded and they kind of leave your sphere of influence. But I think the other piece, you sort of talk about the low-hanging fruit. And yes, I think a lot of schemes have done that. But I think the next bit is also where are the opportunities, and it's actually in that sector, which are the companies that are going to be doing best. So I think that's where our focus has been, in terms of, yes, you've got your sort of allocations to different sectors and you're not necessarily trying to take views there, but actually it's those companies in each sector that are going to come out best on this journey. So the other thing we haven't really spoken about is just the active stewardship, because again, I think it's all that work that happens behind the scenes once you've got that company in your portfolio to kind of actually set them actions, make sure that they're delivering and they're taking it seriously. And I think that has a huge benefit. It's perhaps been underestimated or underplayed by the industry, but I think it's really, really important for that. And we are seeing more of our managers kind of having dedicated programs looking at, say, the top 50 companies that have the biggest carbon emissions, or the top 30 companies that are most exposed to sort of nature related risks. So I think those sort of programs and those approaches will become more prevalent as we go forward.
That's a really important point. I was wondering if we can even touch on stewardship, because it's such a can of worms, but so important for DC investors, and especially in pooled funds. So like, you start seeing them step up a bit more and sign AGM statements or something, investor statements, to back certain resolutions. So that's quite interesting. I wanted to just come back to the reality in a way for DC investors. Like, obviously, it's a lot of talk about investing in active strategies and so, but at the moment where they are at is that they're facing these cost requirements. Most of them are realistically based in index strategies still, and also facing a huge number inflow of assets. I think this is something maybe for Joe as well. How do you navigate that? Because that will increase your total emissions on an annual basis, probably massively, that your assets are growing.
Yeah, it does. So when I look back at our TCFD report for the Master Trust, I can see that our assets have grown a lot, but also our total carbon emissions have grown with those assets. And on the face of it, that looks kind of quite stark, and people might say, well, what are you doing? But actually, effectively, what's happened is we've taken on other companies' pension schemes, and we've inherited those emissions. So it's kind of, you'd expect it to increase at a total level. I think key for us is that if we look across the book, and if we say that the position of those schemes and our emissions before and after, actually the emissions would have come down. So one of the measures that we look at least to assess sort of the effectiveness of what we're doing, is intensity-based measures. So we look at carbon footprint, just because it allows more comparability across different asset sizes. So I think that's an easier comparison. And it certainly allows us to look at, actually, if we introduce this strategy or we do make this change, then actually what does that do to our overall sort of carbon profile? And that then sort of takes away the question of, actually, your assets have grown fourfold, sixfold, eightfold, and that your emissions have gone up with it. That said, our targets are based on total emissions. So at some point, that total picture will need to be our goal. But my sense on this is that even though your assets are growing and your emissions are kind of going up, if you are reducing your footprint and you are doing all the right things in your strategy, actually, that should happen naturally. And I do think it's important to take those small steps first, rather than sort of letting the challenge get in the way of doing anything.
Yeah, I'll just maybe comment on both of those things. Obviously, we look at companies, so we would always want to be looking at intensity measures. So probably emissions divided by revenue. That is an inflation problem. So there's problems with all of these measures. But very broadly, we want one unit of economic activity to be responsible for less greenhouse gases next year. And we see that as a sort of good thing in terms of that business having invested in its efficiency, invested in its operations in line with the transition. So yeah, I think absolute emissions can be quite misleading. As I said before, if you have a company which has half the intensity, we want its absolute emissions to grow relative to its sector, because that suggests overall the sector is decarbonizing. So you can get overly focused on measures that kind of tilt you in the wrong places. And I think that sort of system-wide piece, it's really important not to lose sight of when you're lending in on, you know, one of 3,000 companies in large cap developed equities. So that sort of chain of how companies interact, that's a sort of data gap. I'd love to get better data so that you can see where the products and services from one company have been sold to another, have resulted in those reductions in emissions intensity, have been sold to another. If you could start to see that supply chain, and it's coming, then I think you could build much more sort of ecosystem investment opportunities. But I just wanted to come back to the low-hanging fruit of decarbonisation. First off, I challenge whether portfolio decarbonisation is a reasonable objective. I think I just want to leave that there. I know that a lot of the DC investors have gone for that. I would very much worry about taking that too far and getting those huge sector biases. But I think I mentioned that, you know, I'm not entirely sure that actually is aligned with climate action either. So if you wanted that kind of transition finance portfolio, I think you could argue for an increase in emissions. You could argue that you wanted to invest in the heaviest emitting sectors because they are critical sectors for the developed world, and because you're finding you've got active selection of the companies who are doing the most to decarbonize. And then you could see actually what your measure is the sort of rate of decarbonisation of that portfolio, but not the overall level of carbon intensity, because you're sort of topping up with the better names as they sort of come through. I think actually translating between, I guess, number one, that kind of target and top level commitment of the organisation into actual portfolios is a really, really interesting and sort of complex step. It's got to take investment beliefs. It's got to take real discussion about the kind of pros and cons, because there's no kind of risk-free option here. And I think as an industry, we need to move away from the metrics themselves. I can give you a whole bunch of exposures, but I can't yet really link the scenarios of the transition to whether they are risk and opportunities. And that's work that we're doing internally now. So is emissions an indicator of transition risk? I'm increasingly arguing against it. I'm increasingly arguing actually that it could be the opposite. It could be a sort of negative indicator, because it's the lowest emitting sectors who are going to have the risk of being rationed away from energy in future.
Yeah, these are in a way two separate topics, right? It's one investing in the transition, the other bringing emissions down. It's leading up quite nicely to my next question, which is, do we need a more active approach to investment management? Do we need to move away from indices if you really want to invest for the climate energy transition?
I guess I'm paid to say yes, but I think we're obviously not ignorant of the kind of cost pressures that are in the fund contribution. So I think there's a sort of, how do we actually take our active intellectual property and enable lower cost investors get access to it? So I think the role of indices will change. You know, I sort of think of the sort of three phases of index maybe. So phase one would be this kind of academic market cap, Chicago school kind of justification. Phase two, I think you started to see those sort of ESG goals being brought in. So I think that climate tilted index is probably an example of that. But it's got that sort of passive feel to it. So it sort of just takes a data point and believes you can sort of just whack it into a portfolio and not have any unintended consequences. And I think phase three is active managers actually getting involved, taking their insights, possibly resulting in more concentrated portfolios, but being able to score, you know, we have transition scoring methodologies, applying them across every name, and then really working in partnership with clients, with asset owners, to discuss exactly how you want to express the kind of views and beliefs that we have in that kind of less concentrated, broader portfolio at a better price point. So I think there's a sort of phase three of indices, which is kind of coming now. And it's a really exciting opportunity for DC, I think, in particular.
Just thinking, as you said, that one of the potential advantages could be, in a way, if you have a slightly more concentrated portfolio, that more transparency on stewardship as well. because they often find it quite hard to see with DC funds, like what are their biggest positions and what is their stewardship approach, because they've got such widely diversified portfolios. It's quite hard to see them as key owners of individual companies.
And look, I think unless you're researching a company, you don't really have a relationship with the CEO, the board. You know, there's a lot of focus on shareholder resolutions, and quite often we would vote against them because they're just not in keeping with our support of management's transition. They can actually be disruptive. They can ask for data which is meaningless for the company, and they can sort of put resolutions on the board which don't actually get translated into anything in terms of the executive. So as active managers, you know, we want to engage. We have an engagement program which is based on making changes at companies. It's very outcome driven. It's not letter writing. We do that. We don't count that as engagement. We don't want these sort of slightly performative engagement actions. We want to set ourselves a goal of changing this business. And that takes potentially years. It takes a lot of touches and consistency. And so seeing that in the round as a sort of active skill set, I mean, you can outsource that with engagement overlay services, etc. But we think actually putting it in the same place as the research and the portfolio management. We use our portfolio managers to do the engagement, so making sure that they can see the person who has the buy-sell decision asking for the company to change is a really critical step.
So what would that look like in practice for an energy company? Perhaps less focus on them reducing their total emissions and more focus on how much they invest in renewable energy? Or
Do they recognize that there's a climate issue? And that's a critical first conversation. So we're members of the NZAM, so the Net Zero Asset Managers. We use SBTI to track whether a company, whether their financed emissions are on an appropriate science-based trajectory towards net zero. So really, in the climate sphere, we're trying to get companies up to the sort of gold standard of SBTI. So talking to them about disclosure, verification of their emissions, talking to them about their strategy and targets that they have, and then getting them into the place where they can go to SBTI and get their targets approved. And so that's the sort of conveyor belt of steps that we would see. So yeah, with the energy companies, getting them to realize that, you know, there's a number of different drivers. It's not just climate change. It could be energy security, and getting them as investors in the renewable sector, getting them potentially doing upwards engagements as well, talking to government, advocating for system.
Joe, you touched earlier on the challenges of like balancing the total carbon footprint and relative progress being made. You also invested, Aon has invested in a transition strategy. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that, how you invest in transition assets.
Yeah, so I mean, I think as I mentioned before, we have a lot of assets invested in equities. A lot of those are passive. So actually having those invested in a way that supports the transition was really important for us, and actually can make quite a big difference to members. So we've seen quite a lot of funds on the market. I think when we started looking at this, most of these were quite, I'd say, backward looking or quite exclusionary driven. So it really didn't work for us. And we wanted something that had a little bit more of a forward looking angle. So we worked with a manager to basically create and implement a climate transition fund. And that's quite a big part of both of our default strategies. But it has a goal to deliver, I mean, fundamentally, we need to deliver returns for members. We have to do that. So it has a return objective, as you'd expect, but it also has specific objectives around some of the climate metrics and accepting whether they're the right place to be or not, but also positive impact. So I think you can do so much around the emissions, but for us, actually, the key things that made it different were actually investing more in businesses that we felt were doing the right thing and actually had those credible net zero plans or were contributing to a just transition. So we're kind of aligned with some of the sustainable development goals to get that, I say, element of positive impact in a passive strategy, which is probably a contradiction in terms, but we wanted to have some reflection of the fact that actually there are companies out there that are doing more, that are in a better place, and we wanted our members to have more exposure to them. And as I said, it's a big part of both of our defaults. It's been up and running for nearly 3 years and it has performed well for members, and actually we've not seen some of the performance challenges that I know quite a lot of kind of climate focused funds have done, particularly around sort of the change in energy prices. But I think, as Nico said, I mean, it's really interesting hearing that and thinking about, you talked about active management has a role. As a big passive investor, I might be sitting on the fence here, but actually I'll say possibly. I was expecting you to say yes. But I think one of the challenges that stops DC investors going active is probably cost, I say probably it is cost, but also some of the increased governance around that. But I think if you can kind of bridge the gap and get something that's a bit more active and has got some of those sort of active insights, but in a lower cost, more palatable format for DC investors, I think that could be a really big win. And that's where I see some of the data that you can bring, some of those insights. I can see that's all kind of starting to come together. So I would agree. I think it's really exciting.
I think we covered quite a lot of ground already. I mean, as DC investors are taking on that more active stance, I mean, there's obviously, if you're investing in a climate tilted fund, you can already reduce the exposure to individual companies. Could we see more active commitments from DC investors to divest from specific companies, or are we still a long while off from that?
Possibly. And I also think it's a little bit about how you frame it, whether it's an active statement that actually I don't want to invest in this particular company because it's doing that, or actually whether it's a kind of function of the process you go through to actually say, I only want to hold 100 companies and these are the best ones, so I'm not going to invest in all these other companies. And I think they're quite different statements. One of the things I am seeing is there is a certain amount of pressure from different campaign groups. And I think one of the questions that comes off the back of that is actually that role of exclusion. And particularly if you're making a statement to say, I don't want to invest in, say, fossil fuel companies, because as Nico said, we all use fossil fuels in our day-to-day life. So I've got a petrol car still, and I've got a gas boiler that's probably on at the moment. And actually, it's thinking about we need them day-to-day, but it's actually how do we get them to transition rather than saying we're going to exclude. Because my real worry is that if we exclude en masse, then at some point they become a lovely takeover target for somebody. And that might be somebody with like-minded interests, but equally it might be a private investor who perhaps doesn't care as much. And that's the danger that they then carry on, but they disappear and you actually have no ability to influence at all. So that's kind of the danger point for me on that whole conversation. So I think the proactive engagement, really, really important. And I think our stance is always we'll engage rather than exclude if we can.
So just to endorse a couple of points there. So one is, as an active manager, we don't call it divestment, right? We call it stock selection. And so we can have a much more positive discussion about why we positively want to invest in the companies that are transitioning well or offering the solutions for the future economy. And we don't have to, we might well have a benchmark, but we are being paid to take active risk against that benchmark. So there's a governance question about where that active risk comes from. Is it coming from a sort of net zero climate change objective, or is it come from our broader alpha discussion? So I think using indices, again, just coming back to indices, to essentially provide governance discussions, descriptions of where it's a sort of client-driven constraint, an objective on the fund versus an active portfolio construction decision. I think there's a role for indices there. So I think the sort of climate 1.0 was about supply destruction, and it felt that it could engage with oil and gas, impose credible transition plans, and exclude those who were not putting them in place. And I think we've learned through various kind of geopolitical events that's not going to work. And actually, the discussion is now, I think, much more productive, and it's about demand destruction. It's about going to the producers of vehicles and internal combustion engines and saying, you guys, you know that you're dinosaurs, right? You need to get onto electric vehicle grid. Is going to the big purchasers of transport units and saying, you understand that this has got to change. It's going to the solution providers who are going to switch my and Joe's gas boiler out for a heat pump that runs off electricity. It's going to those places and saying, actually, your ability to transition is the critical piece which is going to switch off the fossil fuel taps. And then I think there's an ethical dimension to fossil fuel exclusions. So people have excluded tobacco from their portfolio because they don't want to profit from that. I don't think they believe by excluding it that they're going to stop people smoking. And I think it's really similar on the fossil fuels piece. So you can certainly have an exclusion. You can certainly sit there and say, I don't want to have profits from fossil fuels, but that's not the same as saying that by excluding, I will get them to switch. I don't believe that that's the sort of hypothesis now, the theory of change now.
So it becomes less, to recap perhaps our entire conversation and lead a bit into my last question. So it's becoming more and more about, rather than just focusing on the carbon intensity of your portfolio, about like identifying the company's best place to transition into a new economy. So do you maybe, to recap our conversation, like say a few words about how do you identify the best companies to transition?
Yeah, well, maybe if I give it a quick go. So it is about the combination of those sort of active insights with data. And there is a virtuous circle there that the data is improving. And we need active managers, I think, to help improve the data because we've got the sector analysis so we can see what the hallmarks of a credible transition are. But on top of that, I think there's a belief set as to where we think the economy is going, which is sort of part macro and part micro. It's part asset allocation. It's part security selection. So I think as a package, active management is a critical step in that. Again, I'm not King Canute. I do understand that defined contribution has a low cost constraint. So working with DC to produce ways of putting that active intellectual property into indices. But just in terms of data points, I just wanted to call out three: CapEx, OpEx, and revenue data. I think they guide you if you can get the right level of granularity of the data. And we need to go and audit the data and verify that it's actually showing us the right things. But I think they can guide you towards companies that are spending money on transitioning their businesses and are generating revenue from these green products and services, which really are the kind of hallmark of the future economy. And that data, those data sets are getting better and better and better. And so, yeah, I think there's more and more insight you can drive from that data now.
I think to echo a lot of that, I think for our members and our clients, it's really thinking about how do we get them exposure to those companies that are best placed to navigate the transition and benefit from it. And again, thinking about being in a sort of passive space, actually, for that, you need a lot of data and you need quite a lot of it and you need very good quality data. So I think that's definitely improving on a trajectory to keep improving. Maybe artificial intelligence will help with some of that as well. But equally, I think where you've got that active management oversight, if we can get to a place where actually we can bring some of those insights and that data and that ability to sort of pick through some of the issues, I think that will be really beneficial for DC members. So that's something I'm very keen to make happen if we can as an industry. Feels like some exciting times ahead.
Yes, it sure does. I think we need to have this conversation again, I think maybe in a year's time or so. Thanks for joining us, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And see you in January.